Session number 10203, Reel 3.
Mr. Nunley, Reel 3.
I think we did our best to train them to fighting efficiency. I think we made it quite clear that the King's African Rifles were superior to any enemy and must inevitably conquer them. I don't think we made a great parade about the whole thing. It all seemed to come naturally that we were looking forward to fighting the Japanese and knocking seven kinds of coloured daylight out of them, notwithstanding the reputation that the Japanese had.
What happened once you got to Ceylon?
Well, there, so far as I personally was concerned, I carried on for a time with my duties as brigade orderly officer. But at the same time, having learned that 26th East Africa Brigade, of which the 3rd 6th was a member, was due to arrive quite shortly, I began to exert the modest pressure that a subaltern can exert to get posted to the 3rd 6th on their arrival in Ceylon. There were numerous rather disturbing incidents whilst the 25th Brigade was in Ceylon. I remember that we'd only been there a very short time at Kurunegala. Excuse me. And the brigade headquarters was, as it happened, very comfortably ensconced in the Loreto convent. And a message came that there had been the most dreadful shooting incident in one of the battalions. And what had happened was that an African sergeant, who I understood subsequently to have been awarded the military medal in the Abyssinian campaign, had been put on a charge for some relatively minor offence and was brought up before the company commander, a Major Guy Rawton. Rawton had pronounced the punishment, whereupon the sergeant broke away from his escort in the company office and got himself a rifle and shot and killed Major Rawton and two other officers before taking to his heels in the jungle. He was hunted down and killed, because he certainly wouldn't surrender. I had to go and see the bodies of these officers in the mortuary, and I attended the court of inquiry. It seemed such a ludicrous incident and such a waste of life, but in my further experience, I came to see that for some reason, some tiny incident would trigger off an African's mind to send him berserk or amok. Of course, it's not the only race that can suffer that. In many countries, in Malaya, for example, I believe it's by no means uncommon, but when it's when you're brought up to it face to face, you might say, it's a very sad experience. It was often said that the smoking of bhang, B-H-A-N-G, as a drug, tended to induce this. But whether that is true or not, I don't know. But there were quite a number of incidents of that kind.
What would make the African react in that way, though? What particular kind of injustice or sense of injustice?
Well, it might be almost any cause. It might be failure to gain promotion from a private to lance corporal. It might be being placed on a charge for some offence which would normally be regarded as trivial, but which offended the man's sense of honour or his standing amongst his mates. Not, I think, any particular identifiable, even reasonable by our standards, cause.
What were the other incidents that occurred in Ceylon?
There was, I think, more than one of that kind where an African took the law into his own hands. That sort of thing. I remember also in hearing of a case in Somalia, Italian Somaliland, where a British officer who was in the Somalia Gendarmerie at some remote place like Cape Gardafui isolated for months on end, had formed a liaison with a Somali woman, and this gave rise to jealousies, and this is only hearsay but fairly well accurate, I think. He was found dead in his bed, pinned by a machete to his mattress. That was the only sexually based incident I ever heard of. I believe I am correct in saying also that in Burma, a certain battalion of the King's African Rifles experienced the horror of an askari tossing a hand grenade into the officer's mess, with fatal results, of course, for some of those in there. That's the sort of thing that probably happens in the units of other countries. I talked about Malaya. I believe, of course, there were incidents, not of running amok, but of officers being killed, even by the Australian troops.
Were there more incidents of this kind amongst the Askaris because they'd been taken out of Africa, do you think?
No, I don't really think so. I think it would have happened irrespective of the country. I don't think it was the strangeness of being in Ceylon or India or Burma. I think it just happened. Not through any united action, but the isolated action of an individual. And there was when I was brigade orderly officer, And this was in Ceylon at Anuradhapura. I had a lance corporal, Kiptyon, who was of the Nandi tribe. Kiptyon was tall, arrogant, at times extremely good and skillful and efficient, and other times the very opposite. Kiptyon had to be reprimanded by me, and he disappeared from the lines. I was told that he had sworn to kill me. I didn't take it seriously, I must say. But he certainly didn't show up. He had disappeared into the surrounding countryside. It was my custom to sleep on the veranda of the single-story building in which we were quartered. And that day, we had a visit from the field paymaster. And he had to sleep somewhere, so I offered him the hospitality of my veranda. And I said to him, look here, I'd better just tell you that there's a Nandi corporal who's out there somewhere who's sworn that he's going to kill me, but I said, I'm not treating this seriously at all, and you shouldn't either, but I shall tell you that it has been conveyed to me. Well, he was very much more apprehensive than I was. I admit that I did put my revolver under my pillow that night, but I slept the sleep of the just. When I woke up the next morning, my complacency was rudely shattered. Corporal Kiptyon had indeed crept up to the hut and had left items of his uniform and equipment 15 paces from my bed. He then, later that day, returned to the lines, and he was punished in various ways, and that was the end of the matter. I suppose I was a bit of an idiot in not treating it a bit more seriously, but anyhow, it all turned out for the best. I'm still alive.
Why do you think he left those items there?
I think it was to show that, possibly, that he, a Nandi warrior, because the Nandi pride themselves on being warriors, of course, had shown mercy rather than actually pin me with a machete. But apropos these incidents, on the 11th of December 1943, the brigade was on jungle exercises. West in Ceylon, west of Trincomalee. I was duty officer that night in brigade headquarters, the battalions being bivouacked in the surrounding jungles. And it was very late at night, probably about 11 o'clock at night. I was sitting in my tent. I was actually writing a letter to my mother. And I heard some shots, not very far away. And very shortly after that, lanterns and could be seen, and padding feet heard. And a whole gaggle of Ceylon villagers came running up the road. very agitated indeed, and as I had the only light on in the camp, they naturally made a beeline for this light. And it transpired that Africans had shot their way into a house in the village and were still there. Now, this was a very interesting situation. Clearly, something had to be done. The matter couldn't be allowed to rest. The honour of the British Army, you might say, the honour of the British Raj, was clearly at stake. As I said earlier, just as everybody else is, I'm a product of my time. So I tried to show unconcerned responsibility, and I told the Lance Corporal, another Nandy, who was the guard commander of the brigade sentries I'd posted, to accompany me with the villagers and we would sort the matter out. Well, it was brilliant moonlight, and I went with the villagers along a road to the crossroads in the village, and the main road was flanked by single-storey houses that looked rather more like huts than houses. Mud walls, wooden doors. So. Now, my Nandy Lance Corporal, and I said it's a warrior tribe, was not as enthusiastic as I was to uphold the honour of the British Empire, the Raj, and the British Army. I mean, he wasn't running away or anything like that, but he wasn't demonstrating a warlike enthusiasm. And I found that he was several paces behind me. I should have preferred if he'd been side by side. Meanwhile, in this brilliant moonlight, looking just about 40 yards down the road at a hut that these villagers were pointing out to me, the most piercing and heart-rending screams were coming from this house. Well, I'm not the bravest of mortals, but obviously I couldn't stand there as a British officer and do nothing. Clearly I've got to do something. And I was told there were three askaris there and that they had shot their way with their rifles into this hut. So I crept down the road, by this time alone, leaving the villagers at the crossroads, and approached the house from which these terrible noises and shoutings and screams were coming. The door was shut. I remembered some of those Western films I'd seen where you kick open a door and jump to one side. So I did just that. I gave a mighty kick to the door, it opened, and I jumped inside this hut, just in time to see the disappearing figure of the last African hurl himself through a window. There was no glass in it, of course. It was an open window, no glass. And the three of them taking off into the jungle. I was mighty relieved. But meanwhile, the scene in the candle light, or oil lamp light, was very faint. It was pretty awful. A man was dying on the floor close to the door, and that awful sort of almost black blood was coming from him. He'd been shot in the chest and stomach, and he died as I was there just looking at him. Against the far wall lying on the ground, but half sitting up, in fact, was a woman. She had taken a ricochet in the breast. She lived. There was, of course, an inquiry. The CID, whatever it was, came up from Colombo. Ballistics tests were carried out on the rifles of the brigade. Nobody was ever found, but the circumstances appeared to have been that as soon as the brigade had gone into bivouac, these Africans had been approached by a man and offered sexual favours if they liked to come to the particular house that night. They'd gone there only to find the door barred. They didn't know, of course, that the man was actually not only barring the door with a wooden lever, but was also pressing against it. So they impatiently opened fire. The bullets went through the door, went through him, ricocheted around, and one of them did anyway, and wounded this unfortunate woman. I felt then that I had put to the test some of those things that I'd learned in all my boyhood reading. And that was the end of that incident.
Were they men caught?
Never.
They just disappeared, didn't they?
Well, they could not be traced. I mean, they were, as I said, the CID came up and plaster casts were made of the footprints that were found. The ballistics people must have carried out trials on many rifles. I wouldn't say they carried them out on 3,000 rifles, but they certainly carried them out, but the men were never found.
How many, were there any other of these incidents that occurred in Ceylon of this kind?
Not in my personal experience, no.
When was it that you actually got across to Burma then?
July 1944.
Under what circumstances?
Well, I'd rejoined the 3rd, 6th in November 1943, as it were, end of December 1943. Much to my relief, I was delighted to be back. I couldn't get back into D Company, and I was sent on a mortar, 3-inch mortar course at Saugur in India, central province, I think it is, and then I was made second in command of the mortar platoon. So I carried on with that activity for those months leading up to July 1944. And indeed, I went as second in command of the mortar platoon to Burma. And we hadn't been there more in action more than a few days in the Khabur Valley than one of those unfortunate wartime incidents occurred. The battalion intelligence officer, Lieutenant Keane, went out on a patrol and came back at a little later than dusk and was most unfortunately shot and wounded by a British unit also in its defensive position. Keane came back not to our own positions but to some British positions, British Army positions, and was most unfortunately shot. And I'm very glad to say he recovered, but that left a vacancy for a battalion intelligence officer. So it was my great good fortune then to take his place.
What did your duties involve as intelligence officer?
I felt very privileged in a way, because although being a platoon commander is rewarding in its own way, being battalion intelligence officer means that you have opportunities not vouchsafed to the ordinary platoon commander of a rifle platoon, for example. One of your principal duties is to lead reconnaissance patrols. For which purpose you are also commanding the intelligence section. The intelligence section can be 20 men, something like that. And they are often very, very good picked askaris and NCOs who have demonstrated particular skills and aptitudes. Also, one is detailed to take part in attacks by, say, a company attack, and the intelligence officer and his section will go with that company to the attack. And, of course, when prisoners are taken, you've got to go through certain routines and drills, and when you've killed the enemy, you've got to take their documents, badges of rank, identity discs, if any, and search the bodies thoroughly and report back. Very, very interesting work it is, almost at times of a relatively freelance kind. It appealed to me because I've always been something of a loner in some respects, and I found that this particular appointment enabled me to do things off my own bat, which I couldn't have done as a rifle platoon commander in the conventional company. For example, I was able to take myself off by myself to go and look at villages nearby. Maybe in some ways it was a bit foolhardy, but the Japanese were in retreat from the battles of Kohima and Imphal, and formal contact with them had been lost at that time in the Kabul Valley. I mean, there were dying and skeleton Japanese everywhere to be seen in the Kabul Valley, in the area of Tamu at the head of the valley at that time. The monsoon was raging, to say the least, and progress down the valley was very, very slow indeed, and a lot of our time was taken up in felling small trees and making corduroy roads by laying the trees transverse to form a track on which the jeeps and other vehicles could possibly travel. So it did afford one an opportunity as intelligence officer of spying out the land. I enjoyed it very much indeed. I really learnt my lesson when I went by myself to a village off the side of the track, about 4 miles. One afternoon, and found that the Japanese had only left a party of Japanese had only left a few minutes before. And I thought, now this is